You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
It is Wednesday, December 6th, and we're talking Cardinals baseball today with our Redbirds reporter, Jennifer Langosch from MLB.com. Jen, as always, we thank you for the time and a lot to get to today. The Cardinals have been busy the past couple days. But let's start here, though, with a guy that is not going to be in a Cardinals uniform in 2018, that being Shohei Ohtani. The Cardinals were one of 23 teams that he eliminated in his quest to become a big leaguer in 2018. Only seven teams, including the Cubs, which Cardinals fans don't want to hear, but the Cubs are still in the running for Ohtani, while the Redbirds are not. And, Jen, I know that certain teams had very high hopes and high aspirations of getting Ohtani in their clubhouse next year. Other teams on the lower end kind of figured he's a long shot at best. So within that spectrum, where did the Cardinals fall in terms of their hopes of getting Shohei Ohtani?
Yeah, the Cardinals never expected to kind of be in the middle of this bidding war. And there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, most notably, the fact that they have spending limits this year because they went over their international spending a year ago. The maximum bonus that they could have offered Ohtani would have been $300,000. And while this is not necessarily all about money for Ohtani, the Cardinals did, you know, expect that to kind of be an obstacle in their talks with him. Now, they did submit the paperwork, the questionnaire that Ohtani, sent out to all the teams, kind of listing why, St. Louis would be a good fit. But in the end, they were not surprised to be on that list of eliminated teams. And I think now if you're the Cardinals, your biggest hope, number one, is that he doesn't end up in Chicago. And number two, most likely, is that, you hope that he ends up in the American League where you don't have to see him all that much. So the Cardinals, again, did their due diligence, sent in the papers, but kind of got the result that they expected all along.
And Jen, the feedback you're getting from fans, is this a real palpable fear that the Cubs are going to get him? I mean, how what's the freak out level right now amongst the Cardinals fan base that he's going to go to their most hated rival?
You know what? I haven't felt much of a freak out yet. I think because everybody's freaking out about Giancarlo Stanton right now. Mm. So, there's a little bit of a distraction here in St. Louis. But certainly I would anticipate if we start here in coming days that list of seven teams is whittled down even further and the Cubs are still in it, then yes, I think that might become a little bit more of a concern to Cardinal fans. I think Cardinal fans right now are hopeful, again, that Ohtani sees a better fit in the American League where he could possibly be used as a DH in some situations. And also this idea that he prefers the West Coast. Obviously, geographically, Chicago doesn't sit on the West Coast. So I think a lot of folks here are hoping that, that lure to the West Coast keeps them out of Chicago.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the hope for Cardinals fans right now. The Cubs, even though they are on the list of finalists, if you will, they're still the long shot of those finalists. So that's something that Cardinals fans can hang their head on. And hopefully they get checked off the list here before long, I should say. And if not, though, like you said, the freakout level is certainly going to be off the charts there in St. Louis. We're going to get to Giancarlo, Jen, in a little bit. But first, the Cardinals did get their hands on a right-handed pitcher who did spend some time in Japan. Just not the guy they were thinking. Of course, not Shohei Ohtani, but Miles Mikolas. He is back in the big leagues after three rather productive seasons in Japan. And tell us about the domino effect that his presence could have in this rotation.
Yeah, this is interesting. I mean, we've talked a lot this offseason about the Cardinals' primary needs being a big bat for the lineup and a closer and probably multiple relievers. Well, the Cardinals' first big move of the offseason is to go out and sign a starting pitcher. But, I think it makes a lot of sense for a few reasons. I mean, number one, Mikolas gives the Cardinals better depth in their starting rotation. Here is a guy who, over three seasons in Japan, pitched quite well, had a 2.25 ERA just this last year while leading the Central League in strikeouts and innings pitched. You look at a team that is going to be without Lance Lynn, somebody who ate up a lot of innings, and a team that is a little bit unsure of what they can expect from their young starters. Bringing somebody else in with experience, somebody who can eat up those innings, I think was very critical. What this move can also do for the Cardinals, of course, is free them up to potentially trade some of that young starting pitching. I'm not sure that they had enough there if they hadn't signed another starter to feel comfortable trading some pieces away. But now when you talk about, whether it's going after Stanton or trying to address another need through a trade, maybe guys like Jack Flaherty or Sandy Alcantara, Dakota Hudson are suddenly in play a little bit more because the Cardinals feel like their starting pitching depth is better than it was.
And Jen, it's interesting that you use the term eat up innings, because anybody that's Googled Miles Mikolas knows there's something else that he eats up, which is rather curious, a very interesting part of his diet, his cuisine. And for the fans that aren't aware of what we're talking about, fill us in on some of the strange eating habits of the newest St. Louis Cardinal.
Yeah, so the newest St. Louis Cardinal will come with a nickname Lizard King. And as you alluded to, that is because he once ate a live lizard before an Arizona Fall League game. That was back in 2011. Fortunately, one of his teammates was gracious enough to videotape this so we can all continue to watch this. I know I watched it yesterday and it made my stomach turn. And, you know, this is a video from 2011, but Mikulas literally picked up a lizard, doused it with a little bit of Mountain Dew, chewed it down, and it had a lot of laughs afterwards. So he still carries around the Lizard King nickname. I'm sure it's going to be a topic of discussion when he gets to St. Louis. And it'll be very interesting to see if he's willing to pull the stunt again or perhaps get any of his other Cardinal teammates in on it.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, just I have not seen the video, but hearing you describe it is making my stomach churn for what it's worth. Was this a dare or a bet, or did he just say, hey, do you have your phone? I want to do something cool.
I don't know. There wasn't a lot of context with the video. So, it wasn't really clear. But he didn't seem to have much of an issue. It took him about 90 seconds after he picked up the lizard to kind of get up enough guts to actually chow it down. But then he made it. Didn't seem to spit it out. Didn't come back up. So kudos to him and a well-deserved nickname.
Yeah, the merchandising possibilities with this are just off the charts. And maybe the Cardinals take advantage of that. We see Lizard King shirts in the gift shop all throughout 2018. Possibilities are endless with Miles Mikulas, now a member of the St. Louis Cardinals. Jen, shifting gears back to Giancarlo Stanton, as you said, you know, Ohtani was kind of a long shot, but Giancarlo is the guy that they want. It's down to two teams, seemingly, the Cardinals and the San Francisco Giants. I think the consensus is that the Giants have the inside track simply because Giancarlo, a native of California, that is his preferred destination, you know, somewhere, if not California, somewhere on the West Coast. So I guess I want to get your take on this. You know, are the Cardinals, do they feel they still have a strong chance at him? Do they feel that it's going to take, you know, something of a Hail Mary to get this guy? What's kind of the pulse right now regarding their chances of getting the NL MVP?
Yeah, well, publicly the Cardinals are stating nothing, which comes as no surprise, you know, but inside the organization, I mean, they're still holding out a little bit of optimism that this can still go through. I mean, Stan, at this point, has not said no to a trade to St. Louis, so he has not completely eliminated them from the list. You know, what they're finding themselves in, though, is just a waiting game, and then kind of the uncertainty that comes with that. Is this a decision that Stan is going to make this week? Is it a decision that's going to linger through or pass the winter meetings? And at what point do the Cardinals feel like they have to pivot in their plans and maybe address, you know, this big bat by going after someone else? So they're stuck in a little bit of a limbo. You know, that being said, we do know that the Cardinals' offer to the Marlins was enticing enough for Miami to want to set up a meeting between Stanton and the Cardinals. That happened last week, and I would suspect that the Cardinals tried to sell a few things to him. Number one, the winning tradition here in St. Louis, the opportunity to jump into a team that is a perennial playoff contender, something that Stanton has never experienced before. The opportunities with so much young talent here that they can have sustained success with him throughout the remainder of that 10-year contract. I mean, I think you point out the fact that Cardinals and the Marlins share a spring training complex not that far from Miami. So, you know, Stanton would spend 7 weeks of his spring there in Southern Florida. And I think the Cardinals tried their best to sell the city. And the reality is, you know, while you'd be coming to play in St. Louis, you're not coming to live here 12 months a year. I mean, he would spend most of his time elsewhere, whether it's in the season on the road or in the off season, wherever he wants to live. So the Cardinals trying to kind of put their best marketing foot forward. But again, this is a Stanton decision at this point. I kind of agree with you. I'm not sure the Cardinals are the front runner at this point. But that being said, they continue to be patient, to wait, and to hope that maybe something will work out in their favor.
Yeah, I mean, time to put on the full court press and cross your fingers. That's all you can do. I mean, it's down between themselves and the Giants right now. It's in Giancarlo's hands, and we'll see if a decision comes down during the winter meetings, which get underway on Sunday. Jen, we're going to talk about that in a minute. But first, a lot of eyebrows raised in recent days with the trade of Aledmys Diaz. I know this one kind of caught me off guard, and he was sent to the Toronto Blue Jays for a minor league prospect. And I know that the 2017 Aledmys Diaz was not even close to the 2016 Aledmys Diaz, who really burst onto the scene as a rookie. But nonetheless, is there some fear that, you know what, you're giving up on a guy way too soon because sophomore slumps, such as they're called, not uncommon amongst younger players, and And maybe that's all this was for Diaz. We know that the talent's there. So, again, is there fear that they cut ties with him a bit too soon?
Yeah, and I think for me, I wasn't totally surprised that the Cardinals traded him. I think what surprised me is that they didn't seem to get more in return for trading him. I say that because as you look at kind of how the Cardinals project in future years, you know, not only was it Diaz's slump that hurt him in 2017, but it was also Paul DeJong's emergence that really hurt Diaz's chances of having a fit here for the long term. So you look at where Diaz might have fit next year, probably as a utility infielder. I think he's very capable of being a utility infielder at the major league level, a guy who can get 300, 350 at-bats during a season and be fairly productive. So that being said, yeah, I mean, I think there was some value there. The Cardinals flipping him for a minor league outfielder, system that already has a ton of outfield depth. You know, maybe this is kind of a diamond in the rough sort of thing. The other factor, I believe, that played into this had to do with salary. And, you know, Diaz was in a unique situation. The contract that he signed coming out of Cuba had him earning $2.5 million last year. This year, he would have only been able to take a decrease of a maximum of 20%. So you're talking about a salary that would have been at least $2 million for him this year. And I think the Cardinals, again, looking at what else they had, seeing that Diaz was unlikely to earn a starting spot back, just didn't want to commit that money to him and figured it was time to cut ties.
Yeah, I think you brought up a good point that the biggest surprise here, not necessarily the trade itself, but what they got in return. I remember seeing the name and immediately going to MLBpipeline.com to see where he ranked amongst the Blue Jays' top prospects, and he was outside the top 30. I couldn't find him. So that really surprised me, and I think that surprised a lot of people, is that the return was certainly less than overwhelming for Aledmys Diaz. But we'll see how it all works out for the Cardinals. We trust John Mozeliak and Aledmys Diaz as I moved on, as have the St. Louis Cardinals as well. Jen, to wrap up this week, we're taking a look back at some notable wheelings and dealings from the winter meetings, as I alluded to previously. Those get underway on Sunday from Orlando, Florida. So, Jen, take us back to 2011, the Cardinals on top of the baseball world as the reigning World Series champions after a thrilling seven-game series win over the Rangers. But that winter, they did have to say goodbye to a franchise icon.
Yeah, and you know, you look at the way they entered the winter meetings there in 2011, the spotlight was on them as defending world champs and also, you know, in the thick of negotiations with Pujols. And then by the time the winter meetings ended 4 days later, the Cardinals kind of ducking out of the hotel, avoiding all media at that point, learning that Pujols, of course, had decided to sign with Anaheim. So, you know, the Cardinals in recent years haven't been all that active in the winter meetings in terms of transactions. So, I mean, that is the one that certainly stands out. Here you had a franchise player, an iconic player, someone who the Cardinals, you know, had hoped would be a lifetime Cardinal, going back and forth in those negotiations, some disagreements in terms of not only money, but years, Pujols not feeling respected at times, as he would later say. But of course, for the Cardinals, a lot at stake. And as I mentioned, by that Thursday morning, the last morning of the winter meetings, the Cardinals learning that Albert Pujols would not be coming back to St. Louis. And it's interesting that we look back on that now because, you know, you think about the parallels of kind of going into this winter meetings. This is a team that is seeking the slugger in Giancarlo Stanton. And perhaps by next Thursday, when they leave the winter meetings, they'll have some clarity there as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting parallel. Like you said, they lost an iconic slugger 6 years ago. Maybe 6 years later, they gained one. So maybe symmetry is in the Cardinals' favor here if Giancarlo does end up coming to St. Louis here in the 2017 offseason. Time will tell. Jen Langosch, great stuff as always. We appreciate the contributions, and we'll talk again soon. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, St. Louis Cardinals. We are into it December. It is Tuesday, December 5th, talking Pirates baseball today with Adam Berry, our Buccos reporter for MLB.com. Adam, as always, we thank you for the time. And Adam, the Pirates, unfortunately, one of 23 big league teams who were basically told thanks but no thanks by the representatives for Japanese phenom Shohei Ohtani. He has narrowed his list to seven teams, and the majority of those West Coast teams, and the Pirates, last I checked, are certainly not that. So, Adam, there's varying degrees of disappointment from the teams eliminated in the Ohtani sweepstakes, if you will. So give me the Pirates' reaction. I mean, did they really go into this, you know, guns blazing, thinking we got a great shot at this? Or were they kind of lukewarm on the pursuit? You know, how disappointed are they that they did not make the final list of Ohtani's seven preferred destinations?
No, they were actually pretty disappointed. I think they thought they had a decent shot to sell Shohei Ohtani on Pittsburgh as much as anything. From some of the people that I've spoken to, the Pirates pitch, had they had a shot in person to speak with him, would have been largely focused around the idea of playing in Pittsburgh, a smaller market. It seems like Ohtani is not really a big spotlight guy, you know, even as much as he's been in it. He's kind of low-key as a person. They saw some similarities between Pittsburgh and his hometown, his home region, that they thought would go over really well with him. And coincidentally, I looked it up, and the capital city of his home prefecture is also a city located in the confluence of three rivers, much like Pittsburgh.
Wow.
So that would have been a pretty decent selling point as well. I think more importantly than anything, though, is that Shohei Ohtani is a potentially, like a nine-figure type talent that they would have been able to get for the $20 million posting fee and basically a pittance. So they were pretty disappointed about that. Not necessarily surprised. Seems like his preference is to play out west, but they were proud of their effort, just a little upset they weren't able to finally land him.
Yeah, it seems, odd that not that he's narrowed this list down to seven teams, but that he's done it so quickly. I mean, he was only posted, not even a week ago, and here we are, 23 teams have been told, I'm not going there. And seven teams, which the Pirates are not among them, have been told that they still have a shot. So, Adam, at this point, now that the Pirates and the fan base have accepted that they're not going to have Ohtani in the Steel City in 2018, is it fair to say that all Pirates fans care about now is that he does not sign with the Cubs because they're the only team that does not play in a West Division that still has a shot at signing him?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. Basically anywhere but Chicago seems to be the consensus in Pittsburgh right now. I think they'd, obviously prefer to see him in the American League, just completely out of the picture because, the Giants, if they were to go out and add Ohtani or if they were to somehow do the unthinkable and land Ohtani and Stanton, that would not only complicate, the NL West picture, but therefore would complicate the wild card picture, which would affect the Pirates and any chance they might have of contending, not just next year, but, for the next couple of years. So I think the Pirates would probably rather see him in the American League at this point, but the one place they certainly don't want to see him is in Chicago. That's the one that sort of sticks out as the unusual team left in that seven-team mix. I guess the only thing they all have in common is that they do spring training in Arizona, and that's certainly one thing the Pirates couldn't do in their pursuit of Shohei Ohtani is move themselves to the West Coast and move the spring training facility from Bradenton, Florida. But I think at this point, people are hoping to see him. Maybe Seattle. I think everybody would be happy for Seattle if that were the case. Maybe Texas even. Follow up in Yu Darvish's footsteps. That'd be a neat move.
Yeah, I think so. And I think Seattle seems to be the front runner in terms of the general consensus among the average baseball fan. Obviously, following in Ichiro's footsteps, who had such a successful stint with the Mariners after he came over from Japan. But we'll see where Ohtani ends up. But we do know that he's not going to end up in Pittsburgh along with 22 other big league cities. Adam, I want to get your take on Ohtani just to kind of wrap up his discussion. We've heard so much about him, the triple-digit fastball, the power from the left side of the plate. He can do it all. He can, when he's not pitching, he can hit. When he's not hitting, he can pitch, and so on and so forth. Are you buying into the hype, or do you think it's a little bit overblown?
I'm buying into the hype, if only I think because I want it to be real. I really want to see a guy do that because I think it would be game-changing, for baseball. All of a sudden, if you have some kid coming out of high school who was his team starting shortstop who could hit and he was also a pitcher, whether it's a one-inning reliever or a starter, does that become more realistic, just going into the future with these prospects? And, I mean, hidden value and, finding value on the margins is critical for a team like the Pirates, anybody in smaller markets, essentially. And I think there's a lot of value to be derived out of a player like Ohtani, who would fill, multiple gaps and multiple holes on your team with one kind of cost-controlled, affordable guy. And I think the Padres showed some signs of that. I was really into the Christian Betancourt thing, where he was going to be the true 25th man, the whatever it was, catcher, reliever type deal. So I'm intrigued. I think it seems like the tools would suggest he's going to be a much better pitcher over here in the majors than he will be a hitter, just based on the strikeout rate and how hard it is to hit major league pitching. But I don't know. I'm curious to see how it all works out, and I think that's going to be something that pretty much everybody in baseball follows with great interest next season, no matter where he lands.
Yeah, I agree. Now, the flip side of having a guy that can, hit and pitch is that if that one guy gets hurt, well, you take a hit to your rotation and your lineup at the same time when one guy goes down. So there is some risk in that regard, but I think it's a risk that a lot of teams would be more than willing to take on. We'll see what Ohtani does in a big league uniform here in 2018. Adam, shifting gears a little bit, the Pirates made some new hires in their coaching and their scouting ranks in recent days, and you wrote how the Pirates have been actually without an official pro scouting director or an international scouting director in recent seasons. Is that rare? Are there other teams like the Pirates that did not necessarily, you know, have those positions? And to kind of piggyback that, how much of a priority was it for the Pirates to fill those roles heading into 2018?
Yeah, it's pretty rare. More often than not, you're going to see a team with a pro scouting director or at least somebody who is in charge of, you know, accumulating all the reports and processing all that information and then relaying it up to your assistant GM, your general manager, or what have you. In the past, Tyrone Brooks kind of held that role. He was the director of player personnel, so he was in charge of domestic scouting and then non-Latin American international scouting. But then he left to head MLB's diversity pipeline program after the 2015 season, and they never really replaced him. They'd kind of been doing it informally and, you know, just sort of, you know, as it was able to be done, basically, in the Pirates front office. So that was certainly a priority. Neil Huntington actually mentioned when he signed his extension with the Pirates in September that, you know, there were some demands that he had, you know, as far as how they did things and the process in the front office. And nobody has come out and said this on the record, but my sense is that this sort of reorganization was part of that. Their hand was forced a little bit because Latin American scouting director Rene Gallo had to be dismissed following some investigation from Major League Baseball. So that's where Junior Vizcaino came in as the international scouting director, not just Latin America. He's in charge of the global efforts, basically overseeing their, you know, their Asian scouts, their European scouts, their Latin American scouts. And then Steve Williams is going to come in and basically just oversee the, you know, domestic scouts and, you know, claim those reports and file them up the front office chain of command. So I think just a more organized process was important for the Pirates. And in part, it's a bigger front office because the game has become so data-driven and information-driven. And that's not just analytics. That's just information. You know, a scouting report is information. And you need more minds. You need more bodies to process that kind of stuff and put it in a way that makes sense and then get it to the decision makers. So I think it's pretty important that the Pirates put people that they trust in those roles. And Junior Vizcaino comes from outside the organization, but he's got a really impressive resume. That's a guy who kind of has been building toward this point for his entire career. And then they really like Stevie within their organization. He's been a longtime scout, longtime major league scout. So he makes sense there. They also, kind of along those same lines, they made Justin Message their assistant pitching coach, which is a pretty interesting role because that's where Ray Searidge got his start before he took over for Joe Kerrigan here in Pittsburgh. And from talking to Neil Huntington, it sounds like most of that job is going to be preparation. It's going to be working with pitchers and catchers, starters, relievers, et cetera, before the game, devising scouting reports and things like that. And, you know, information has become so important in this game that that's basically a job in and of itself. Ray Searidge gets so much credit for what he's able to do mechanically, but it's hard to do that while also doing the scouting reports and running through the data, the heat maps and all that stuff. So I think this just sort of organizes their process a little bit better, which is a little bit of a focus heading into this offseason before they even get into the whole transactional part of the hot stove. It's just improving their process so that it can be better and more efficient.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing nowadays. You know, you cannot have enough data, information, scouting reports, you know, eyes on the ground around the globe. It's crazy. It's a 365 day a year process, and the Pirates are ramping up those efforts to find those hidden gems, which they certainly pride themselves on. And Adam, to wrap up here, we're looking back at some previous wheelings and dealings from past years at the winter meetings, which get underway in earnest this Sunday. So take us back to 2006 and a little saga involving Mike Gonzalez and Adam LaRoche.
Yeah, this is before my time. I actually went back to our Pirates.com beat writer at the time, Ed Eagle, who's still the editorial producer here at MLB.com, and asked him for his memories on this. And yeah, it was a fairly prominent trade of pretty valuable assets at the time, Mike Gonzalez and Adam LaRoche. You know, the Braves needed a late-inning reliever. The Pirates wanted some left-handed power at the corner. And apparently the deal was agreed to at the winter meetings, as reported by our own Ed Eagle and Mark Bowman, but then it was pulled back through some drama there, I guess, that happened, and it wasn't completed for another month in the end. And, you know, it was a decent little acquisition for the Pirates. Adam LaRoche was a solid first baseman for a while, not for very good teams, unfortunately, but, you know, he was kind of a presence there. You look back now, and he was the last first baseman to start on consecutive opening days for the Pirates. So, you know, it was an acquisition that worked out well for them. It just sort of took a little longer than they expected to get there.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy how some of these deals go down. You know, the average fan watching at home just sees it, you know, scroll across their screen and, okay, we got this guy or we lost that guy. But the backroom dealings sometimes are the more fascinating part of these trades and these transactions. And, Adam, that is certainly a good one there and a good place to wrap up. Adam Berry, our Pirates reporter, joining us here on this Tuesday. Adam, we thank you so much, and we'll do it again next week. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Pittsburgh Pirates. We're talking Brewers baseball today, this Tuesday, December 5th, with Adam McKelvey, our Brewers reporter for MLB.com. Adam, we thank you so much for the time. And the big newsmaker this week is obviously a guy that does not play or has never played in the major leagues. That will soon change, of course. Japanese phenom Shohei Ohtani narrowing his list to seven teams, of which he will play four in 2018. The Brewers, unfortunately, not on that list. They are one of the 23 teams that Ohtani said thanks, but no thanks to. What were some of the measures that the Brewers were planning on taking to kind of woo him? Because I know that, you know, a lot of teams are feeling kind of left high and dry, that they had these big pitches and proposals ready to go, and Ohtani just said, "I have no interest." So, what was the Brewers' reaction to that?
Well, look, I mean, David Stern says he respects the process. This was obviously a unique situation, and look, the player has the right to do this process the way he wants to do it. I mean, he's giving up $200 million to come now, and I think the Brewers respect that this is the way he wants to do it, and they weren't among the finalists. I mean, they did send in, obviously, the questionnaire. Every team, we assume, did. The Brewers sent along some multimedia materials, and look, they have their pitch just centered around basically that this is a young ascending team. He would get to play 81 games at a ballpark. That's a really great place to play for a home player, in the dome and really favorable conditions. Even visitors love coming to Miller Park. Great place to hit, a team that needs pitching. And, you know, they put together the best pitch, and it wasn't enough to get among the finalists. You know, I think their feeling is he and his representatives probably had a pretty good sense of what the final teams on that list were going to be. But look, every team was given an opportunity, and the Brewers just weren't on the final seven.
And one team that is on the final seven, to a lot of people's surprise, a division rival in the Chicago Cubs, as the other six teams play for West Division teams. The Rangers, not a West Coast team, but they obviously play in the AL West, so the Cubs are, you know, the team that kind of stands out amongst those seven as a team of the NL Central. When you look at the, you kind of, you know, get the pulse of the fan base right now. Is the Brewers fans feeling okay? Well, if we can't have them, the Cubs better not get them either.
Well, they're getting a double dose of that right now, because as we speak, Giancarlo Stanton, it looks like he's down to Giants or Cardinals, and I think there's an even stronger feeling among the fans here against the Cardinals after all the pain they have caused this fan base in Milwaukee. And so, you know, if the Cubs get Ohtani and the Cardinals get Stanton, I don't know, it's going to be a dark Christmas here in Milwaukee. But what can you do? I mean, those teams are making their best pitches for either player, and if you're a Brewers fan, you just got to deal with it. And David Stern has said that all along. Just from a broader point of view, you know, the Cubs look like they're built to be good for a long time. But the outlook, I think, from inside the offices in Miller Park is all you can do is build the best team you can build and try to build it to be, have some sustained success. You can't necessarily make moves or react to what the division rivals are doing. And I think, you know, the fans, that's easier to do. Maybe when it's your job, for the fans, it's a little more difficult to do, but look, that's the only alternative. You can freak out about this, it'll drive you crazy, or you can just, you know, sort of cross your fingers and hope he goes out west.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's Giancarlo's preference is to go to the Giants, but the Cardinals are still certainly in the running. And, you know, look, the team that spent the most money this year did not win the championship, the Dodgers. You know, the Yankees didn't win it either. The Astros didn't spend a ton of money. But, you know, there are no guarantees. You know, even if Giancarlo goes to St. Louis, even if Ohtani goes to the Cubs, no guarantees. Put the best team on the field that you can and let the chips fall where they may. And, Adam, to kind of wrap up the Ohtani discussion, I want to get, you know, all the reporters' takes on this. We've heard so much hype about Ohtani, a lot of it justified. You know, he does have the triple-digit fastball. He does have the power from the left side of the plate. But, you know, sometimes there is overhype. You know, we heard about the gyro ball from Daisuke Matsuzaka. I still don't know what the hell that is. But it never came over to the major leagues when he signed with the Red Sox in 2007. Some guys do live up to the hype, you know, Hideki Matsui, Ichiro. So I guess on that scale, in your eyes, where does Ohtani fall? Are you buying into the hype 100%, or do you have some reservations?
No, I am buying 100% into the hype because, to me, you know, I don't think he's going to be Babe Ruth. But I don't think he has to be Babe Ruth because at the very most, the outlay for whichever team gets him is going to be $23 million, $23.5 million. For $23.5 million, I mean, you can get a nice number three starter for 2 years, or you can get this kid who might be great for 6 years, and even if he's not great, he's going to pitch for you and hit for you. He's going to sell a lot of tickets for you. He's going to, you know, make a lot of money for you in merchandising. I just think this is just a win-win-win-win-win for whichever team gets him. So in that sense, the hype is, to me, pretty certain to play out in favor of the team, whether or not he actually becomes the next coming of Babe Ruth.
Yeah, and it's going to be fascinating, too, to see, you know, with whatever team signs him, how they will deploy him. You know, how often does he hit? You know, will he be a starter? Will he be a reliever? You know, that's an option, too, I think.
I think on that, Matt, one thing is, you know, everyone may be overthinking that a little bit at this stage. I think it's going to just be, what's he good at?
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing to say that just because you set a plan to woo him that involves this many starts, this many at-bats, this many days in the case of an American League team as a DH, this many days in the field. You know, I think everybody, including the player and his representatives, will concede that plan can be changed along the way based on what he's successful at, and it's in his interest to do whatever he's most successful at the most amount of time, because then when he finally does get to free agency and really cashes in, he's going to want, you know, his best foot forward, and that means sort of going with whatever you do better in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, it's going to be an ongoing process. You know, he's not going to be locked into any, you know, one or two or three things. You know, it could start out one way, but then as the season, you know, progresses, you get to the All-Star break, you kind of figure out, okay, he does this better than that. And it's going to be an ongoing process to see just where he fits in best. And, you know, the duration, the frequency, and everything that goes with that, it's going to be fascinating to see this process evolve with Shohei Ohtani here in 2018. Well, Ohtani is not going to be a Brewer, but Stephen Vogt and Jeremy Jeffress will be, as they both re-up with the club, avoiding arbitration. One-year deals for both, and talk about those signings, Adam.
Well, look, I mean, they're club-friendly deals. I don't think there's much doubt about that, and this is sometimes you can write a story and it's about a player avoiding arbitration and a possible non-tender. And I think it's the case here in both cases. Now, the projections are what they are. They're just projections. But they did come in under what was expected for both. In Jeremy Jeffress's case, the Brewers get a couple of club options. They can pick up those options. They can decline, go into arbitration with them. They can decline, let them go after next season. They have a ton of flexibility, a ton of control over Jeremy Jeffress's future. But I think in both players, it's an opportunity to, number one, lock up a job or as close as you can with a non-guaranteed contract, have some certainty of where you're going to go, and go to a place where you had success. Stephen Vogt was very productive when he came over from Oakland. The Brewers got him on waivers last year. And in the case of Jeremy Jeffress, this is like three times now where he's come back to the Brewers and had success. You know, his roots are there, number one draft pick. Obviously, he's had well-documented troubles with some drug suspensions. He's come back, reestablished himself in the organization, became their closer, then got traded to Texas, really struggled there at the start of last year, came back again in the trade, and was pretty good at the end of the year. They're working on him with a splitter. and they think he can be a productive reliever in the back end of the bullpen. It's very low risk, I think, in both cases, and there's sort of an opportunity for both sides to come out here, with a plus. So for Jeffress especially, that bullpen is an area that we haven't talked much about, Matt, in our podcast, but that's an area where they need to do some work this winter with Anthony Swarzak in free agency. They need some help in front of Corey Knebel, and I think if Jeremy Jeffress gets back to really his, the form he's shown in a Brewers uniform, he could be part of that mix to kind of help get the ball to Corey Knebel.
Yeah, there seems to be a gravitational pull between Jeffress and the Brewers as they keep reuniting and it keeps being productive. So
he's
going to be
to the candy store.
Exactly. Yeah. So Jeffress back with the Brew Crew yet again here for 2018, along with Stephen Vogt, and we'll see what kind of a prominent role each of them play for the Crew in 2018. Adam, to begin to wrap up, we're looking back this week at some wheelings and dealings from winter meetings past as the meetings get underway in earnest on Sunday down in Florida. So, Adam, take us all the way back to 1980. The Brewers acquiring a couple of guys, one a future Hall of Famer that would help form the nucleus of the pennant-winning team just 2 years later.
Yeah, well, we're looking at sort of the biggest winter meetings deals in Brewers history. I think technically this one happened after the folks left the hotel in Dallas in 1980, but it was between the Cardinals and Brewers, who would, of course, eventually meet in the 82 World Series. And this trade had a lot to do with that. The Brewers got Raleigh Fingers, of course. He's the Hall of Famer. The mustachioed with a fan favorite he became here in Milwaukee. Ted Simmons, who a lot of people, including our friend Richard Justice, says should be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
I sort of agree with that. A really great catcher, one of the smartest people I've ever had the pleasure to meet in baseball. We still see him a lot because he scouts the NL Central. And Pete Vukovich, who became the Cy Young Award winner for the Brewers. They got all three of those guys in a big deal with the Cardinals. It cost them Sixto Lescano, who was a popular player. But really the key to that deal is one of these forgotten prospects, David Green, who was one of the biggest prospects in baseball at that time. And there was some pretty heated discussion in the Brewers front office at that time. Harry Dalton was their GM. And, a really sort of back and forth about whether the Brewers should make that trade. You look back on it now, and oh my gosh, what a deal for the Brewers to get these incredibly talented players. But so much was thought of Green at the time. The name Roberto Clemente was tossed around as a comp for him. So it was a difficult trade for Harry Dalton to make. Obviously, it turned out to be a really spectacular trade from the Brewers' point of view because it propelled them to really their most glorious seasons. And, the one thing about that, as you look back on it, is it also is sort of a story of the way the winter meetings have changed. I think Whitey Herzog, who was the Cardinals GM at the time, traded like 59 players at those winter meetings. Check my math on that, Matt.
I will.
Huge, spectacular number as he was remaking that franchise. And, it harkens back to the days where it was smoke-filled rooms and, lots of bourbon and sort of the skids were greased and a bunch of trades would happen. Those days have obviously changed. It's now text. It's spreadsheets. The game operates in a different fashion. And look, not one's not better than the other. Everybody's liver is a little bit more in functioning order at this point in time. I love when I do get to meet up with some of my more veteran sports writer friends and sort of hear them spin stories about winter meetings past, because it was sounds like it was a lot of fun to be part of.
Yeah, a whole different ball game back then. It certainly was, and it seems like it was a little more fun. Not that spreadsheets and databases and stat casts aren't fun, but the way you described it back in the 80s, it was just a different era back then. And before I let you go, if the Badgers come back to beat the Buckeyes, I'm sorry. I got to get your take, though. If they come back and win that game, they have to be in the playoff, right? I mean, there's no way the committee could have not let them in, correct?
No, and my understanding is that's pretty much what they said.
Yeah.
So, great season. It stinks when your team goes down, but it was fun. It was, it was fun to hear them talked about in the discussion with these just really elite programs with all these great athletic players. And the Badgers do it with a big offensive line and a quarterback who does just enough and always a great running back and then a spectacular defense. There's a bunch of ways to win. We talk about it all the time in baseball. There's a bunch of ways to win in football, too, and, man, they got close.
Yeah, they did. They did. They got down early in that game. They came back but didn't have quite enough. Do you agree with the decision to leave Ohio State out and put Alabama in? I certainly agree.
Emphatically. I think that's a great decision. And I know my friend Ohio-born Travis Shaw will have a nice conversation about that the next time I have the pleasure of being in his company when he wants to remind me of the outcome of that Wisconsin-Ohio State game.
Absolutely. I think they got it right. Ohio State, okay, you won, you're conference champ, but the four best teams are going to be playing on New Year's Day. I don't think there's any argument there. Adam McKelvey, great stuff as always. We'll do it again soon. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Milwaukee Brewers. We are finally into the month of December as 2017 winds down. It is Tuesday, December 5th. The winter meetings are right around the corner, and today we're talking at Reds baseball with our good friend Mark Sheldon, Reds reporter for MLB.com. Mark, we thank you for the time today. And, Mark, the Reds, along with 22 other teams in baseball, have learned that they will not be acquiring the services of the Japanese phenom Shohei Ohtani as pretty much within 2 days after he was posted, he gave his list of the destinations that he wanted to end up in. A lot of West Coast teams, the Reds are clearly not that. So, again, the Reds, one of the 23 teams not on the list for Ohtani. And I know there's varying degrees of disappointment depending on what team you are with regards to the hopes you had of landing this guy. So on that scale, where does the Reds' disappointment rank that they're not even going to be given a chance to try to woo this guy and get him to Cincinnati next season?
Well, unfortunately, I've not been able to get a hold of any of the Reds' front office people on the phone. So I've not heard from Dick Williams. I put in a request for it, and I wasn't able to get him. But I can tell you is that they made a full court press to try to get him. They worked very hard going back to September to prepare their recruiting materials. They wanted him badly, and they knew they were long shots. So I'm sure they're not too shocked they're not on the last set of finalists. But Dick Williams was among several MLB executives who went to Sapporo to watch Ohtani's last game. Came away very impressed. He also really tried to work to put together recruiting material that might appeal to him. They kind of realized because he was coming out at the time he was that he wasn't necessarily chasing the top dollar. The Reds were capped at $300,000 with their international pool money. So they knew they had to appeal to his senses outside of that, and they thought maybe the market size, the fact that he had a chance to be on a team that's on the cusp of getting out of rebuilding and getting into contending maybe would appeal to him and things like that, and it just didn't work out. So they're going to go back to the drawing board and see what else they can come up with.
Yeah, like you said, it's interesting that he doesn't necessarily want top dollar. He doesn't necessarily want to play in a big market. He seems to prefer the West Coast, and with the exception of the Cubs, all the teams on his list are West Coast teams. The Rangers, too, they play in the West, but they're clearly not a West Coast team. So very interesting list that Ohtani had with where he wants to end up in the major leagues, but the Reds, unfortunately, not on it. And, Mark, you had a very interesting note, which I don't think many people realize. I certainly didn't before I read it. The Reds are the only team in the major leagues to have never signed a Japanese player. I found that, again, interesting and rather surprising. So when you look back, Mark, have the Reds ever been close to signing a Japanese player, or have the circumstances, for whatever reason, just not been quite right?
They've definitely not been close, from my knowledge. I've never known them to be in the hunt for the Hideki Matsuis or even the guys, Kaz Matsui or Sota Gucci, even the lower-tier Japanese players. What I can tell you is that they had a very Spartan Asian scouting department in much of the time I've been covering the Reds, but on the last year or so, under Dick Williams, they've decided to ramp it up, and they've added a bigger presence in Asia. They are going to start scouting more in Japan. When Williams went over there to look at Ohtani, he also wanted to signal to Japanese clubs around that league that the Reds were open for business with Japanese players, and they wanted Japanese players to know that as well. So they are hoping that even maybe not players obviously as big as Ohtani, but other Japanese players could view the Reds as a destination to further their careers, and they're certainly open to doing that despite some of their international pool restrictions. It's a market that they want to start tapping into a little bit more.
Yeah, and it appears that 2018 will not be the year that the first Japanese player joins the Reds organization, but maybe it is somewhere down the road in the not-too-distant future. And, Mark, to wrap up the Ohtani discussion, your personal opinion, are you buying into the hype? Do you think this guy is everything that he's being billed to be as the Japanese Babe Ruth, so to speak, or do you think that maybe it's a little overblown?
I'm sure to a degree it's overblown. I have not ever really seen him play. I didn't get to catch any of the times he was in the World Baseball Classic, but I will say that when you can throw about 100 miles an hour and hit with power from the left side, that's a pretty good pedigree, and I'm sure there's going to be some level of adjustment to the major leagues, being that he was on a schedule in Japan where he pitched once a week and hit the other days. I don't know how he would fit into a five-man rotation and whether major league pitching would wear him down as a hitter or not, but I'm definitely interested to see what he can do. I guess the Reds, in a sort of a way, have their own version of Ohtani and Hunter Green that will hopefully, for them, make his way up to the system. He's a guy that can supposedly hit really well and obviously pitch about 100 miles an hour. So maybe they'll get their version of Babe Ruth in the next few years or so.
And, Mark, that is actually a perfect segue to the next topic, which brings us to the just-concluded Reds Fest in Cincinnati. And Hunter Green, of course, was on hand. And one of many highlights for the fans that attended the Reds Fest. And, you know, Hunter kind of saying to you and other media members, you know, I'm an 18-year-old kid. I don't know what the big deal is. Well, the big deal is what you just talked about. He can throw triple digits. He can hit for power, and he may be the next big thing in baseball. Of course, that's years away. He's still a teenager, of course. But, you know, talk about that. Talk about some of the other highlights from your perspective from the 2017 Reds Fest.
This Reds Fest was a little unique in the sense that, obviously, there was the regular star power of the current roster, Joey Votto topping the list, but Billy Hamilton and Adam Duvall, et cetera, et cetera. But this year, it seemed like the prospects were getting a lot of attention, namely Nick Senzel, their number one prospect, and Hunter Green, the number two prospect. Senzel came to Reds Fest last year, but he wasn't exactly a household name to the way that Green was. And sure enough, when the very first autograph session that had Green involved was happening midway Friday afternoon, there were several hundred people already lined up, and the line was closed. They already had to close the line because it hit capacity. And he signed everyone's stuff, and he was a big draw at Reds Fest. Anytime I saw his name on an autograph session, the line was full. And Senzel was getting that way as well. I think there's a lot of hype for both players. They know the fans, that these guys are part of the future. There's a great expectation that they'll be in the major league soon. Senzel could be in the major leagues as soon as 2018. Hunter Green, possibly a minimum of 2 years away. But there's a lot of expectations, and people want to see Hunter Green. His reputation obviously precedes himself, and he handled himself extremely well. Just talking to him, you would never know he's an 18-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. He sounds like he could be 35 or 40. Just a very gracious, a very very poised human being, and he seems to get it. He autographed everybody's stuff on a personal level, which is a bit of a departure. It made the line go slower, but I think fans appreciated the personal attention and the chance to talk to him.
No question. And you go back to when he appeared on the cover of SI over the summer, and people were likening that to when LeBron James appeared on SI's cover as a, I don't know, 16 or 17-year-old, you know, with the label The Chosen One, and they were, you know, they nailed that one, and they're hoping that's Hunter Green, that the hype and the projections for him are as LeBron-esque as they were back for the King all those years ago. So Hunter Green is off to a good start, and we'll see if that continues as he continues to mature and improve his game. Mark, to wrap up this week, what we're doing is looking back at some wheelings and dealings from past years at the winter meetings, which get underway in earnest on Sunday and continue all throughout next week. So take us back to 2006, almost a dozen years ago, and a very interesting tale on how the Reds got their hands on Josh Hamilton. I don't think people quite realize something that was in place before the Rule 5 draft even occurred. And this was interesting as to how Hamilton, after battling those horrific drug issues he had back when he was originally drafted with the Rays, he comes back, he ends up in a Reds uniform, and take us through how that actually happened.
Yes, it's an interesting story. The meetings back then were also in Orlando, and it was a very quiet week for the Reds. And then suddenly the Cubs announced they were taking Josh Hamilton in the Rule 5, and then they promptly flipped him to the Reds. And the backstory is that Hamilton, the Reds realized that Hamilton had cleared waivers during the winter and was on the Tampa Bay AAA roster available for the Rule 5 draft. And Chris Buckley, the Reds' director of amateur scouting, scouted Hamilton extensively when he was the number one pick in 99, back when Hamilton went to the Rays and when Buckley was at Toronto. So he had a pretty good knowledge of what Hamilton could do back then. Obviously, after all the drugs and suspensions, it wasn't exactly the same as it used to be, but they found out he was working out in Clearwater. They took a lot of looks at him. They got a lot of tips that he possibly had put his drug problems behind him, and they took a long look at him. And they compiled the intel, and Buckley ran it by Wayne Krivsky, who was then the general manager, and they realized that it wouldn't be much of a risk if they took him. It would be a $50,000 risk. But the one problem they had was that year the Reds were the 15th pick in the Rule 5 draft, and they were worried that other teams would take Hamilton ahead of them, and maybe they were all thinking the same thing. So sure enough, the Cubs made it known that they were not taking a player in the Rule 5. They drafted third, and Chris Buckley had a relationship with the director of scouting for the Cubs named Tim Wilkin. Actually, Wilkin was the best man in Buckley's wedding. Hmm. They worked together in Toronto for 16 years, so they really knew each other well. And at a scouting gala during the winter meetings, they came together on a deal. They wrote it out on a cocktail napkin. They didn't tell the Cubs who they wanted. They just said, we want to move up and take your pick. And they agreed to give the Cubs $50,000. And then about a minute before the draft was actually made, Buckley handed Wilkin the piece of paper. Wilkin opened it, looked at it, saw the name, Josh Hamilton, and said, go big or go home. And he really liked the pick, and he stuck to his word, obviously. The deal was done, so the Cubs went ahead and took Hamilton, and the Reds got him. And it was it really did kind of work out for them that one season. He hit about .292 and 17 homers. He was on the DL twice and some durability issues, but they got what they hoped from him, at least in that year. And then they turned around and they flipped him to Texas the following season for Edinson Volquez, kind of fearful that he might break down. They were concerned about his injuries and things like that. They maybe sold him a little too soon because obviously Hamilton went on to great things with the Rangers, had an MVP season, but the Reds are definitely responsible for getting Josh Hamilton back on track in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, you look at what Hamilton did, and like you said, maybe the Reds gave up on him a bit too soon because I think about 2 or 3 years after that, he, like you said, had that MVP season, had the unforgettable home run derby performance at the old Yankee Stadium, and, you know, certainly made the most of his second opportunity to wear a big league uniform. Mark Sheldon, great stuff as always. We thank you for the time, and we'll do it again at this time next week. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Cincinnati Reds. On this Tuesday, December 5th, we're talking Cubs baseball today with Kerry Muscat, our Cubs reporter for MLB.com. Kerry, we thank you for the time, and the biggest news item is a positive one for the Cubs, as they tend to be. Shohei Ohtani has been the man in the news lately, first and foremost, more than anyone else, as he has officially been posted. He has narrowed his list to 7 teams of where he'd like to end up in 2018, and to a lot of people's surprise, based on geography, the Cubs are on that list because the other 6 teams all play in either the NL or AL West. The Cubs clearly do not, so they still have a shot at this, Kerry. And when you kind of look back and, you know, people are trying to figure out, you know, why the Cubs and not, you know, another team, what are your feelings on this? You know, why are the Cubs still in this thing when he's made it pretty clear that he does prefer to be on the West Coast?
Well, I can't speak for Ohtani, but what I'm thinking is that there might be just the Wrigley Field mystique, mm-hmm. and the Cubs mystique might have something to do with it. It also could be that Ohtani also got a little sneak peek at the Cubs facilities in spring training this year in Mesa. According to a story I found in the Kyoto News, he had been there. Apparently his Nippon Ham Fighters team trains in Peoria, Arizona every year. They kind of get their spring training started there. And he had gone to the Cubs facility to get some treatment. I think he was dealing with an ankle injury or some kind of injury, but he'd gone to the Cubs to get treatment. So he knows what their facility looks like, and it's fairly state of the art. It opened in 2014, I think. And it could be that if you consider all the teams, the 7 teams, they all train in Arizona. Hmm. So obviously that is a draw to him. He doesn't want to go to Florida. And it could just be that the Cubs do need starting pitching, so there's an opening if he's interested in there. I'm always curious if he's been in contact with some of the other Japanese players that played for the Cubs. It could be that there's just been some gossip. You know, they've talked to each other. It could be that he's intrigued by playing for Joe Madden, who obviously is known for some of his innovations and could be kind of a perfect match.
Yeah, it really could. And Joe Madden has gone on the record in saying how intrigued he is by having a guy with Ohtani's background and skill set at his disposal. And, you know, like you said, he's one of the more innovative, outside-the-box thinking managers in baseball. So, Kerry, kind of elaborate on Madden's comments about, you know, just how intrigued he is at the prospect of having Shohei Ohtani on his roster.
Well, Madden has told us before, actually, since Ohtani's name came up, you know, and the fact that he was coming to the major leagues, you know, Madden has told us a story about a minor leaguer in the Angels system back in 1992, a guy by the name of Deshaun Warren. Apparently, Warren was a left-handed pitcher, but he also was really fast. So Madden wanted to see if he could somehow have this guy, have Warren pitch, but also use him in the outfield to take advantage of his speed on the days that he wasn't pitching. So as Joe has said, he's always been kind of intrigued by the concept of having, you know, a two-way player. And if you flash back since he's been with the Cubs, he has not been afraid to put pitchers in the outfield. Travis Wood most famously made a great catch up against the Wrigley Field wall.
Right.
And you know, he's, so it might just be that it's something that I'm sure Joe would love to tinker with, and we'll just have to see what happens.
Yeah, maybe the Cubs end up winning the sweepstakes, as you know, like you elaborated, they're still on the list, to many people's surprise, given his preference to be with the West Coast team, but certainly do not count the Cubs out. And Kerry, to kind of wrap up the Ohtani discussion, I want to get your take on just your opinion of Ohtani and his talent and his skill set. You hear varying opinions about how it's going to translate to the major leagues. You hear about the triple-digit fastball. You hear about the power from the left side of the plate. Are you buying 100% into the Ohtani hype, or do you think that it's maybe a tad overblown at this point?
You know, I don't know. I have not seen him. I have not talked to scouts really that much. I couldn't gauge, but I do know that there certainly seems to be a lot of hype. And if you have someone who's, 23 years old and has the skill sets that he obviously has, it'll, like I say, it'll just be intriguing to see how it translates when he comes over here to the major leagues.
Yeah, it certainly will. Whatever team gets him, you know, how they deploy him, you know, as a pitcher, as a hitter, how often does he, you know, does he ever sit? Does he, you know, would he land better with an AL team with a DH option? A lot of things to sort out, and we'll see if the Cubs, if he narrows the list even further, if they make this a second cut, so to speak. Kerry, shifting gears here, the Cubs deciding to not tender a contract to Hector Rondon, their former closer, as he is now officially a free agent. And Rondon, of course, held down the closer's role in the world title season of 2016. That was before a guy named Aroldis Chapman was acquired at the deadline, and Rondon had to take a backseat to him. Looking back, Kerry, you know, was he ever the same pitcher after Chapman was acquired? It just seemed like, you know, he had a few more ups and downs and hiccups than he had before Aroldis arrived.
He wasn't having that great a year in 2016, and he wasn't the kind of dominating closer like a Chapman or a Kenley Jansen is. He wasn't the kind of guy, or you know, Trevor Hoffman in his day, the kind of guy that Mariano Rivera, when they come into the game, boom, it's over. You know, you just had that feeling. There was always Rondon just wasn't as consistent in terms of his pitches. To his credit, though, I think what people, hopefully Cubs fans, remember is that this guy went from a Rule 5 draft pick. He was the Cubs' Rule 5 pick and went from that to their closer in for 14-15 and most of 16. And handled, when Chapman arrived and then this year, with Wade Davis arriving, he handled the transition and being kind of delegated to setup guy just as professionally and smoothly as anybody could. Handled himself well. I give him credit for that. This is a guy who was the Indians a long time ago as their Indians minor league pitcher of the year, and then had injuries. So he really accomplished a lot. It just was always hard for him to kind of get back on track. And if he had a couple of bad outings, it took a little bit for him to get back on track. And I think that might have contributed to some of the lack of success.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for any professional athlete with any shred of pride, as these guys all have, to be told not once but twice that, you know what, we got a guy in here that's a little bit better than you. First it was Chapman, and then it was Wade Davis. But as you said, he handled things with the utmost professionalism. And, you know, tough to see him move on, but hopefully he will land somewhere and be an asset to whatever team he plays for in 2018. Kerry, to wrap up here, what we're doing this week is looking back at winter meetings past, some wheelings and dealings that go on kind of behind the scenes, with the winter meetings getting underway in earnest this coming Sunday. So, Kerry, take us back to 2006 and the Cubs coming to an agreement with Ted Lilly in the most unusual of circumstances. Elaborate on that, if you could, for us.
Well, Jim Hendry was the general manager at the time, and had been kind of popping antacids, thinking that he had a little indigestion or something, wasn't feeling well. Lou Piniella was the manager. Someone else in the front office finally convinced Hendry to go to the hospital to get checked. And it turned out that he was having a heart attack. But that didn't, of course, stop Hendry. As he's on a gurney, about to undergo the EKG, he's talking on his cell phone to Ted Lilly's agent and finalizing a four-year, $40 million deal. Of course, the agent did not know that Hendry was on the gurney and hooked up to this machine. And Hendry said to this day he can't figure out why he had the phone in his hand, but he was not stopping. So they once after the EKG was done, I guess Piniella took the phone from Hendry, told the agent what was going on. Hendry, of course, not to be outdone, called Lilly while he was still on the gurney to kind of confirm the deal was set, and didn't give him a heads up. And Lilly found out later, but it was, which is something they can all laugh about now. After they finalized that, Hendry was put in an ambulance to be taken to a hospital 30 miles away to undergo an angioplasty, which saved his life. Hendry's now 62. He's a special assistant with the Yankees, and he's very thankful. And he was joking, the doctor, and I'm not going to try and pronounce the doctor's name, but the doctor has told Hendry to call him Dr. J. And of course, Hendry told him, you better play like him. But the doctor saved his life. He was a cardiologist and a specialist there. And it's just a funny, I remember when it happened, I was covering the Cubs, and I remember we were all nervous because we knew that Jim didn't exactly take great care of himself and was a little overweight. So the fact that he was having a heart issue was kind of not a surprise. But as Hendry was in the ambulance on his way to this hospital, he said he's on the phone calling Cubs staffers, you know, I want you to do this in the Rule 5 draft. I want you to do this. I want you to do this. And finally, the paramedic said, hey, buddy, you know, you might want to call your family because you don't know what's going to happen with this procedure here. And so I think that was a little bit of a wake-up call. And he survived and is feeling great and, you know, couldn't be more thankful. And to top it off, he's hoping to hook up with the doctor. Says he sends him a couple bottles of wine every once in a while and is hoping to hook up with him when that he's back in Orlando next week.
Amazing story. And Kerry, I'm guessing that when his family, you know, got word of this about what he was doing as he's literally trying to fight for his life, I'm guessing this didn't go over too well.
Well, he called his kids, who were 10 and 8 years old at the time. And the kids, of course, they were supposed to come down to Orlando on the Friday after the meetings, and they were going to spend the time at Disney. And of course, his daughter, Lauren, her concern was whether or not they were still going to get to go to Disney. So, which I think is a good attitude.
Sure.
But he wanted to just make sure that he called them so they didn't see something on TV about their dad, you know, before they heard it from their dad. So I think that was they handled it pretty well.
Yeah, it all worked out for the best, thankfully, fortunately. And Ted Lilly has one hell of a story to tell to his kids and grandkids.
Yes, about he does.
Yeah, absolutely, when he signed on with the Cubs back in 2006. Kerry Muscat, great, great stuff as always. We'll do it again next week. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras Chicago Cubs.